Hi, and welcome to Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host today, Dr. Amber Luong, from the McGovern Medical School of the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston. Today, I've invited Drs. Alan Workman and Jim Palmer to discuss their manuscript entitled The Completeness of Surgery Index Predicts Success in CRS with Nasal Polyps with Asthma by SNOT-22 and Asthma Control Test, and it's currently in early publication. Dr. Workman did his rhinology fellowship at Penn and is currently faculty at Mass Eye and Ear, and Dr. Palmer has been a rhinology faculty at Penn for over 20 years. So, guys, welcome Alan and Jim, and thank you both for your time today to discuss this concept on the completeness of surgery index and how it can be used clinically. So, Jim, let's start with this index. I think it's a really important concept, the whole idea of how do we really enumerate the completeness of surgery or how well it's done. So what prompted for you to kind of generate this and basically give me a little bit of the feedback on or understanding of how this was calculated?
So there's a short answer and the long answer. The short answer is 20 years of working doing sinus surgery, plus there's a big difference between a good surgery and a bad surgery, and we all know it. At least all of us that do good surgery, or we think we do good surgery. But the problem is there's never been a number on it. And it's always been the thing that's bothered me, even with sinus, chronic sinusitis itself. We try and do the SNOT-22s as a number, but it works reasonably well, but it's not as good as we want it to be. And so what I wanted to do and have wanted to do for a long time is have some mechanism to say, did you do a complete surgery or not? And so been talking about it with a lot of years with a lot of fellows. And then here comes one Alan Workman, who I had known as a medical student at Penn and was fantastic. And then he was an even better fellow. And I'm yapping about it while he's doing a draft 3 drill out. And I'm, no, go there. No, go there. And then we're talking about why this patient is going to do better. So we started to say, well, we need to create some sort of index. So big picture for me, I can't stand these indexes that have a points of 1 or 2 and it's a total of 24 or 48 or whatever the number is. I want to be 0 being nothing and 100 being everything. So I said, okay, we got to start with that. Then we said, all right, well, how are we going to break that down? And I had my ideas where I thought each sinus should be 10 points. Both sides, that's 80. Then we'll figure out what we're going to do with the other 20 points. And okay, Workman, being a less simplistic mind, said, no, what we really got to do is look at the surgeries that you've done revisions on, that we have the CT scan on them, and really see what you did that was different and if it matches up with their SNOT-20s. So one piece of this story you got to know, it goes all the way back to when I first started at Penn. Bill Bulger was my predecessor, and we practiced together for about 6 to 8 months. And he used to love to talk about how getting a CT scan after surgery helps you so much. So about 2004 or 5, we got a Zorian CT scanner in our office, and I stick a lot of people in there after surgery, even though I think I can see pretty well, even though I think my endoscopic view is good, if I'm just trying to figure out what's going on. So it turns out that on our scanner in our office, we had in excess of 50 patients pre-op who had had polyps. So first had polyps. Second, it had a CT scan before I did their surgery. And then third had a CT scan after I did my surgery. So we knew a bunch of things. Number one is they were all revision surgery. Number two, they were all treated the same because I'd give basically, I'm a very patterned individual, so I gave them the same amount of steroids post-op. And they all were on steroid irrigations, which I think actually is one of the secrets behind all of this. Is that when we're doing polyp surgery, or at least at Penn, we're not just taking the polyps out. We're also designing the sinuses to do better with irrigation. And everybody is on irrigation. Now, maybe some of them aren't doing it as much as I'd like them to and so on, but we have a very high rate of them doing surgery irrigation. So that gets to Alan sitting down in front of the scanner and looked at 50 scans one by one, writing down very detailed looks at all the pieces and what parts were taken out, what parts weren't. Okay. And then after that, we came back to every sinus is worth 10. And then we had 20 points to deal, or 10 points left over to deal with. Alan, take it from there.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the most important things to us from, you know, a broad bird's eye level view was to keep it as simple as possible so it could be used by rhinologists, by ENTs, by radiologists, even by allergists who are looking at these CTs. And where you get bogged down is if you really have to know the anatomy well, you know, and you're assigning something 1 point and someone else might assign 2 points and it's really, really granular, people kind of lose the forest for the trees. And so we tried to design it as simple as possible so that you could get a really good gestalt of where a patient is at, but not nitpicking 1 point here or there. And that kind of led us to the development of the index where you get 0, 5, or 10 points for each of the sections, which I'm happy to talk about now. So the index itself, you know, as Dr. Palmer had alluded to, you have the maxillary sinus, the ethmoid sinus, the sphenoid sinus, and the frontal sinuses. Each of those is worth maximum of 10 points. And then there's a miscellaneous category of draft three and middle turbinate resection, because that kind of adds the completeness of surgery to everything. So what's the most surgery that you could do would be that draft three to manage the frontal sinus. And so going through each, an untouched maxillary, ethmoid, sphenoid, or frontal gives you 0 points in that area. And again, we're looking specifically at the bony anatomy, not the soft tissue. Okay. So it's static with polyp burden. You get 5 points if you do an antrostomy in your maxillary without getting it largely open under 70%. You get 5 points if you did some ethmoidectomy, but there are some complete cells that remain. And again, that's on either sagittal view or a coronal view. You get a 5 points for a sphenoidotomy on the axial CT, and you get 5 points for a draft 2A. Finally, to get your 10 points in each section, you get 10 points for a maxillary if it's greater than 70% open on coronal CT. You get 10 points if there are no complete cells left in the ethmoid, meaning there can still be some ethmoid roof partitions hanging down, but you're able to see the entire skull base. There's no complete cells remaining. You get 10 points if the sphenoid is greater than 70% open, and you get 10 points in the frontal if you do a draft 2B. That leaves us with a maximum of 80 points for the sinuses. And then, as I talked about, a draft 3 gets you 10 points, and a partial middle turbinectomy gets you 5 points. And so that really underscores the hallmark of our polyp disease management.
Okay. And how, I'm just trying to think about, you know, going back to your point about trying to make it as easy as possible for everyone to give a score. Everything made sense up until like 70% of the maxillary antrostomy, 70% of the sphenoid. How is that calculated, or how can an average rhinologist figure that out, whether it's a 5 or a 10 point?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a fantastic question. So one of the other things we really looked into was using multiple raters on each CT to see what the inter-rater reliability was for this. And what we found, you know, that 70% cutoff was actually fairly easy to determine. You know, ultimately, you're not nitpicking. There are some cases where you could go 10 or 5, you know, in that location. But certainly the vast majority of what we saw with the complete surgery, it was very obvious what a complete surgery was versus a more limited antrostomy.
Okay.
The reason we picked the 70% was after looking through those 50 scans, doing multiple measurements, really, really looking at the actual, you know, bony width that was left, but ultimately left it to kind of a little bit of a less granular detail.
The couple things that popped into my head while we were talking. Why bone? The CT scan don't lie. So it doesn't matter how many people come back and tell you what a good polyp surgery you did or you didn't. The scan is objective. So that's why we went for bone.
Okay.
You could have a cold and all of a sudden there's a bunch of polyp burden or swelling. Is that a cold? Is that polyps? What is it? If you took the bone out, that didn't grow back. So if you want to say you did a complete surgery, that bone's got to be gone. So why did we name it COSI? We fooled around in the OR for multiple days of cases trying to come up with a better thing than that. But COSI just fell out. Every time we tried to change it, completeness of surgery index was what fell out. Now, the 70% rule, when we tried to do 50%, it just wasn't so obvious. You're fighting, you're on the fence, 50 or not.
Okay.
70, man, if it's 70, it's pretty much all the way open. You can fight a little bit, like especially if you're going through the axials and you're looking at your sphenoid. Of course, there's going to be little edges of the sphenoid along the optic recesses there and so on. And so if there's a little bit of bone there, who cares? that's, you're still going to be over 70. If they didn't open it up really wide, it's way under 70. And so 70 became a nice sort of quick cutoff. And to add in what Alan said, I mean, I do cosigns on everybody now. I can knock them out in under 15 seconds sitting in front of the scanner on my Zoran. But that's different because I've got all three versions right there in front of me. But when we did it at Penn and we did blinded interrelator reliability, we were under 5 points either way every time someone sat down and did it. Because it's just one of those things when you look at it, it's wide open, boom. It's not so wide open, you could still have your 5 points. And if you didn't touch it, you didn't touch it, and you can tell. So that's why it came and worked out so well. But the real question or where it went to was, okay, so we had this scale that we thought was going to be all right, but did it actually match up the SNOT 22s getting better? And so that was what was so great about having all those pre-scans and post-scans that we'd had over a 20 year period of me doing them at Penn. So we took them and put them all, how much surgery you had before and how much of a bump did you have in your SNOT 22. And that's when that number of 70 popped out with a pretty good statistical difference. Now, I was surprised it was 70. I thought it might need to be more than that. Mm-hmm. Number one. Number two, I was sure that anybody that had 100 was going to still be great. And I operated on some people that had 100 going in because they regrew their polyps. Mm-hmm. And they'd already had a draft 3, and I went back and did another draft 3. They sealed over. So know that for the listeners, know that it really was done in an all-comer setup where everybody that came through, we had done the surgery, and then we took a look at it and said, okay, how's it break out? Now, that was just, it looks like the index should work. Now, Alan's going to take us through the first paper, which showed, yes, it does work, and it works better than biologics. Yay!
Go ahead, Alan. Okay. Well, why don't, if you can do us just a quick elevator pitch and remind us what that first paper was, and then let's dive into the second one with the now looking specifically, now including not only SNOT 22, but asthma in this kind of cohort.
Absolutely. I elevator pitch for the first COSI paper demonstrated that patients who were coming to a revision surgery who had a COSI of less than 70, meaning they had previously incomplete surgery, subsequent to the revision surgery, they had a SNOT 22 average improvement that was durable of about 28 points, which is a great improvement, you know, well above the differences that anyone cares about, and certainly more than a lot of the biologics show as well. But that cohort that was getting revision surgery who already had good surgery, that was a COSI of 70 or greater, their SNOT 22 improvement was only 14 points in that group. So that group was really showing us these patients who haven't had good surgery are benefiting tremendously. And the patients who, you know, maybe we're banging our heads against the wall a little bit, trying to get a little bit better, we're not necessarily doing as well as, you know, perhaps we'd hope for those patients. So that paper kind of really honed down on that this 70 cutoff was meaningful in our polyp patients and was something that we could use to help stratify patients who would benefit from, you know, surgery and a good revision surgery before they would be going to other therapies like biologic therapies.
So now for this study, it was a retrospective review of just CRS with nasal polyps and asthma. So they had to have both. Is that correct?
Correct. And very importantly, we didn't include any of the same patients in the two papers. So that ultimately, you know, if we go and do a systematic analysis or a meta-analysis of these papers, we're not having overlapping cohorts in there. But we selected patients for this second manuscript who had asthma and polyps.
Let me hop in for a second to pull up. Go back to big picture, and then Workman will take it on the next steps in the pieces. So when we did COSI, we knew that this is where we were going. We were trying to find something that showed surgery is not just surgery. Complete surgery is meaningful. And like I said, our audience understands that. Now, way back when, advertisement for myself, I published in 2001 or two, took a bunch of patients from Northwestern that had surgery before, and then Rob Kern et al. Did a complete surgery. And we actually just looked at global amounts of prednisone they were taking for their asthma, and it dropped like a stone. And that's something we all know about. We know this was before unified airway was even discussed. And there have been papers that have been out there forever that if you got a bunch of pus in your head, your asthma is going to be worse. Pretty simple. But to prove that, we needed to have a cohort of patients that had had an asthma control test. Well, that's the beauty of having John Basso in your office. So we have a full-time allergist in our office, John Basso, who sees all of our most difficult patients, which means he's automatically doing an ACT, an asthma control test on them. So it was just a matter of digging through and finding enough polyp patients that Basso had seen before we did our surgery so we could have, because we don't routinely do asthma control tests. So we've got our asthma control test pre and our asthma control test post, and then compare them with their co-size, and then voila, we get to prove that yes, complete surgery makes you do better. So we knew that was coming. There's some geniuses in there that Workman placed, which was everybody had to be in a different cohort. So our first 2021 cohort, the reason why we chose 2021 was as biologics were available. And it was 3 years out, 3 or 4 years out. So we would have a long enough time for people to nitpick at us and say, oh, you didn't give them enough time. Did you get a durable result? So on and so forth. Well, the next piece that we're thinking about is we need to get to a meta-analysis showing that COSI is a worthwhile thing. Because no matter what you do, when you put these things out, people come at you saying, well, why is 70 the number? What about bad funnel disease? How do these break out? And so you just got to build the numbers. And one of the ways to build the numbers is to every time you publish on it, you publish with another cohort. So then some enterprising medical student at, UT Houston comes to a professor and says, hey, let's write about this. And then next thing you know, it's showing up in a meta-analysis. And so that's kind of what we were thinking about when we set this down. Now, Alan's going to go through piece by piece how we did it.
So this is a separate cohort. So just make sure I understand, a separate cohort than the first paper that you guys, where you introduced the COSI concept. So these are patients with asthma. And I think what I understand from what Jim was saying is that they had confirmed diagnosis of asthma based on a pulmonary function test, as well as a preoperative ACT, which is an asthma control test. Can you go over a little bit about what the ACT is for those of our, you know, listeners who don't know what that ACT score is? And then what did you guys do in this particular study?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, the asthma control test, very helpful, gives us a number, kind of a numerical quantitative outcome for these patients. It's a validated questionnaire, assesses the degree of asthma control based on the frequency of exacerbations, the frequency of related symptoms, use of rescue medications, and all of those things that we think matter in terms of control of the disease. And it's typically assessed by the patient over the prior 4 weeks. So the patient is really thinking about, you know, how their disease is controlled, you know, in that immediate setting. So higher scores show that you have better asthma control. Lower scores show uncontrolled asthma, with a score of less than 20 being uncontrolled asthma. And that was about a third of our cohort.
Okay. And what's the scale from 0 to what?
25.
0 to 25. So anything less than 20 was considered uncontrolled asthma. Okay.
Correct.
And so for this particular study, can you give us, summarize some of the demographics in these patients and any particular aspects of the demographics you wanted to point out? So some of you kind of highlighted some of it was that, I guess, a significant proportion were uncontrolled or less than 20, right?
Correct. Yeah. So 34% of the patients, about a third of the patients were uncontrolled asthma. A good portion of the patients, a little over half the patients, had AERD, which is the natural, concept of the Penn cohort, where Dr. Basso sees a lot of AERD patients. The remainder were just, you know, normal polyp disease, obviously without aspirin sensitivity. And then, you know, looking at baseline SNOT scores, average was around 44. So, you know, pretty typical, you know, type level of disease. And then the average baseline asthma control test score was around 20. So, you know, again, there's a third of that cohort below, but the rest of the patients were still, you know, still had moderately or, you know, mildly controlled asthma. So ultimately, you know, this was a cohort of patients that we think is pretty typical for these tertiary rhinology practices, perhaps AERD a little bit overrepresented, but we made sure to control for that in some of our subsequent analyses. So, you know, really what we were looking for in this paper was to look at this distinct cohort. You know, we know a lot of polyp patients have asthma, but specifically looking at the patients with asthma, number one, validating the fact that our SNOT 22 improvements, you know, correlate with our COSI scores. So validating our first paper, which we did successfully. And then, you know, the subsequent question was, do the people who have this uncontrolled asthma, are those the ones who get better if their COSI is low? And we found that, you know, of those patients who had the uncontrolled asthma, there was a significantly greater improvement in the asthma control test postoperatively compared to preoperatively in those patients with less than 70. And we didn't see that in the patients who were greater than 70. Again, that was statistically significant. And okay. So again, really hammering down that not only is this a relevant cutoff, we see this across multiple distinct populations of patients, and it's relevant even beyond sinonasal disease. It's relevant to, you know, the pulmonary disease burden as well. So this was certainly something that was interesting to Jim and I.
So let me make sure I understand. So it sounds like in those severe patients with severe asthma that were not well controlled as defined by an ACT score of 20, those patients, after they had a COSI of less than 70, so incomplete surgery, those patients did really statistically much better in terms of their asthma control. Am I getting that right, Jim?
Yes. Okay. So, I mean, it's funny. You dig into the numbers and the statistical things that come out, and mm-hmm. I keep going back to the big picture, which is, if you did the surgery you set out to do originally, you'd get the results you came to get, right? So unfortunately, our allergy colleagues run into this all the time. And the more I do this, the more I realize, you know, there's three things that go on. One is the surgery that actually happened. There's the surgery that you claimed and the surgery that you billed for. And unfortunately, those three things oftentimes don't match up.
Yeah.
But the CT scan doesn't lie. And I know that there's a whole lot of people out there that will turn and say, well, wait a minute, why am I getting CT scans postoperatively? I'm increasing radiation exposure, so on and so forth. And my response is actually pretty simple, which is, before you start a lifelong anti-inflammatory, such as a biologic, with side effects that we don't even begin to know about, let alone the economic cost, let alone the personal cost, why don't we just check and see if that first therapy that we said we were going to do, that we really did what we set out to do? And it's a way of making sure that our local therapy does its job. I don't think there's anyone that will argue that for, let's just take asthma, if you can do well with topical corticosteroids and long-acting beta agonists, you know, basically your Advair inhaler, then you shouldn't go on steroids and you shouldn't go on a biologic. Well, if your surgery does well with your topical irrigation, then you probably shouldn't go on to a biologic. So this is part of us helping us understand our first round of therapy and make sure we're doing a good job with it.
Alan, just to make sure that there is some good, I guess, consistency with the COSI and the SNOT 22, did the results of the COSI and the correlation with SNOT 22, did that still was consistent with the original paper with a different cohort of patients?
Yes. And so it was actually, it worked out incredibly well. So after the revision surgery, there was actually a SNOT 22 improvement of 30.8 in our COSI less than 70 group. So even better than the original paper.
Okay.
And then the 70 or greater group still had a pretty robust SNOT 22 improvement, but it was only 20. So still obviously substantially worse. And again, that was statistically significant, the difference between those two cohorts. And so, you know, again, these patients with this severe polyp disease, also with asthma, are improving with our surgeries, but certainly the ones getting revision surgeries for previously incomprehensive, non-comprehensive surgery are doing much better.
So that makes me want to jump in real quick and just point out that in both of our cohorts, the people who had a COSI greater than 70 still got better from surgery. They just didn't have the super dramatic improvement. They got better by 10 to 15 points, which frankly is what a lot of the patients in the biologic studies improved by. So I am not about to say that if you've had a complete surgery, you should have no more surgery. What we're saying is you should always have a complete surgery before you move on to the next step. Now, the next step might be another surgery. The next step might be a biologic. The next step might be any of a whole host of different treatment modalities. It's just, it's a way to make sure we're getting that first step, which is oftentimes surgery, done in a way that we're sure that we're making a clinical difference.
That makes sense. Well, so that was a great segue for AERD patients. I know that your institution commonly have them after surgery proceed on to aspirin desensitization. So my question to you is, can you extrapolate whether or not, let's say, I see a patient who comes in, they had a COSI of less than 70, so they didn't have complete surgery yet. I go in there, I revise their surgery, and I did get a post-op CT scan, and it looks like their COSI is now over 90, and their ACT, as your study showed, did improve, their asthma control improved. Does that help us figure out whether or not they would be a good candidate for aspirin desensitization, meaning that they'll respond, or is there any correlation there?
Yes and no. And the reason why I would say yes and no is we get a lot of people that are sent to us for aspirin desensitization, mm-hmm. and Dr. Basso gets a new CT on him and says, oh, what you really need is a complete surgery first. Then we'll cross the bridge on aspirin desensitization. And we've got a bunch of people that have never got aspirin desensitized because they didn't need it. So we routinely schedule it for about 6 weeks after. We'll have plenty of people that say they just didn't need it anymore, or they'll get desensitized. And then a year or two later, they'll stop doing their aspirin and then they'll just never go back. And so the way I like to think about it, for better or worse, is local versus systemic therapy. Right. So asthma is best treated locally with inhalers. Polyps are best treated locally with surgery followed by topical irrigation. When those don't hold, they don't make the patient do better enough, defined by patient symptoms, then you need to move on to systemic therapy. Systemic therapy in the past was aspirin desensitization for the AERD patients. It was oral steroids, unfortunately, in bursts, and that's about all we had. Now mm-hmm. we have biologics, which is fantastic. And if you look at our numbers big picture, both in our 2021 study and this latest study with the asthma control test, about 10% of our patients are on biologics. And thank goodness they're there. That is an incredible outcome. Those patients do so much better. They are incredible drugs. We're just trying to find the right spot for where they get used. They get used better after an appropriate surgery and a patient is irrigating with steroid well and doing their topical steroids for their lungs better. And at that point, if they still have symptomatology, it's time to start thinking about a biologic or aspirin desensitization. And so we still do a lot of aspirin desensitization because we give our patients the choice. Do you want to go on a biologic or do you want to do aspirin desensitization? We'll have plenty of them that are still doing that. Mm-hmm. We also have a fairly good sized referral base of people who have had some sort of problem with a biologic, that they have some sort of allergy, joint pain, so on, and they'll decide they want to come on do aspirin desensitization. So there's still a space for all of these treatments. It's just, we want to make sure we do our local treatment really well before we move on to systemic treatments.
That makes sense. So, and I'll throw this out to either one of you. So, I mean, it sounds like this whole concept of having some sort of way to enumerate, you know, to classify how well our surgery has been done. That concept is great. It's primarily been done at Penn. So is there a way, should we talk about how to validate this? Is it generalizable? You know, are you guys looking at maybe having other people look at this COSI and see if it can be, you know, taken at another institution? You know, what are your thoughts?
Our hopes are that everyone will, that they'll pick it up and use it and have that be their way they decide whether a surgery is complete or not. We do have some multi-center studies in the works. And, okay. You know, I look forward to the podcast in six months or so when we go over that and talk about that. And we'll have more than just Alan on here. We'll have a bunch of other surgeons that have done the surgeries. I think this is one of these things that, you know, we're just trying to put a label on that which we already know. We kind of know a more complete surgery is better. The one thing that I'll always throw out there too is this 70% number. It's kind of funny. Alan and I fought back and forth on this a little bit, but I think the reason why that 70 sort of shakes out is you can't get there. You can't get to a 70 unless you can do a decent frontal and you can do a decent sphenoid. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to do a decent sphenoid and you're going to do a decent frontal, you're probably going to do a good ethmoid. And a good ethmoid is the seed of disease of polyps, which means now you got yourself into the 80 category. And whether or not the draft three or the middle turbinates plus minus, that seems to be, it goes back to the original principles of endoscopic sinus surgery, right? You always got taught that the ethmoid was the seed of disease. We can't really do a good ethmoid unless you're doing a good sphenoid and a good frontal and a good maxillary. Boom, you're at 80 points. And so I think that's why the 70 cutoff keeps shaken out as a reasonable number.
To piggyback off of that, I mean, we definitely hope that people are picking this up. We have a whole multi-institutional study that's enrolling patients right now. So we should have some data from other places soon, as Jim alluded to. You know, kind of picking up what he was saying about the 70 cutoff, I think it's very important that we're not trying to say, you know, X person is 5% better at surgery than another person. We're just trying to get a really nice gestalt value for what a good sinus surgery looks like. And so, you know, that 70 cutoff appears to be a good enough surgery quantitatively and really qualitatively. If you look at the scans too, you would say that, you know, that surgery was done by someone who knows what they're doing.
Perfect. All right, guys, I think we covered that pretty well. And I do agree that we need some sort of index. And I think this is a phenomenal way of evaluating this. And I very helpful, you know, because I remember always discussing, well, not every surgery is exactly surgery. So just saying, especially if some of these new algorithms that we're coming out with, right, Jim, that we're saying, you know, if they've had surgery, then move on to this. But not every surgery is the exact surgery. So I think this is going to be extremely helpful. And I hope that it too takes off so that we can better assess whether or not when we see patients who are having recurrent disease, whether what treatment options are available to them, whether or not another surgery is going to be helpful, or maybe we do need to move on to either making sure they're doing their local treatment or a systemic treatment option for them. All right. Any other last minute take-home messages?
Just do those cosis because it actually teaches you a lot. And I will say the other thing that before anybody comes back at me on it, I will tell you that you will humble yourself quickly by getting postoperative CT scans. You will realize the things that you missed and you'll become such a better surgeon because, you know, surgery is a lifelong endeavor and a process of continual quality improvement. And that CT scan afterwards really just teaches you where you weren't and where what you wish you had done.
I completely agree. All right, guys, thank you so much. Thank you both for your time today and insight, and a happy 2026 to you both.